Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast, the show in which we explore the future of the internet. I'm your host, Julia Jensen. I'm an artist researching the impact of technology on our society, and I'm a data protection ambassador. Data Morgana is an initiative by Public Spaces, a network of civic society organizations reclaiming the internet as a force for the common good. It's 2025. The internet has fallen into the hands of a few big tech companies. Under the promise to make our world better, more fair and efficient, they collect our data on a massive scale. But does this really make our world a better place? Or is it nothing more than an illusion, a data morgana? In this show, we're looking into hopeful initiatives happening around Europe that are shaping a better digital future. I just had a conversation with Corey Cheo from New Public about the Public Spaces Incubator project. This project is a collaboration between New Public and six international public media service broadcasters: ABS Australia, ARD Germany, CBC Radio Canada, SRG, SSR from Switzerland, and ZDF from Germany as well. Their goal is to develop prototypes for digital conversation that increase healthy connections and engagement in civic discourse. Corey and I talked about reimagining social media. With the Public Spaces Incubator, they distinguish three main topics within the social media landscape that need to be revised. Let's hear about their research and ambitions for the future of social media. Well, hi, Corey. Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast.
Thank you.
So when I open the website of New Public, I see in big and bold letters, reimagine social media. And my first thoughts are, yes, that sounds super exciting. Let's go. Because I've honestly been struggling with social media a lot lately. And I think many of us are. But I'm actually curious to know more about what you actually mean by that. How and why the social media needs to be reimagined?
Pick a reason. I think at New Public, New Public was actually founded a few years ago, before the pandemic, on this body of research called the Civic Signals, that was looking at the aspects of digital spaces then, and looking for the sorts of things that made them welcoming and functional, as well as what sort of created toxicity or chaos in those spaces. And so this is, you know, pre-pandemic. This is already kind of looking at the vulnerabilities of these platforms that by then have become like so ubiquitous. And out of that body of research, there was sort of an underlying thesis that public space in physical space serves an essential role in our societies, and online there's so few spaces that are not privately owned and with the sorts of incentives that, you know, we've seen have become kind of baked into how these private spaces, online spaces, are created and what they are designing for. Attention sort of fed by then conflict. And not sort of taking into account sort of how do you design for a space that feels welcoming to everyone, that is trying to solve for people being able to see each other and be in a space in a collective way. And so there's, like, I feel like a question under that, a metaphor that's really helpful, has been really helpful from the start, which is sort of, let's take an analogy of a public space in the physical world and kind of ask what the same might look like in a digital space. Like, what would a park be designed to do on the internet? What would a library be designed to do on the internet?
So there was maybe a lack of purpose for these public spaces within the internet, where it was only captured by commercialized spaces, commercial companies, shareholder interests.
And I think more and more, like at the time of the when Public Spaces Incubator started, which we'll talk a little bit about, these large public media organizations were sort of on they had for years been connecting with their audiences through social media and had really shifted their internal organizations to be able to meet people there. But then shortly after the project started, there were cases around the world, starting in Canada, where essentially these big social platforms were starting to cut their relationships with news, whether that be like where it's served in the algorithm, whether it shows up in a Google search. At that point, after these organizations had moved their relationships to these private spaces and the private spaces started to abandon news, there was this this real sense of like, oh, these are not the infrastructure that we need or that we were counting on. Like all kind of privatized industries sort of start to realize like where you're so dependent on
They were
infrastructure acting in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. They were on the one hand banishing maybe news from the platform, but also understanding that the things that make people like angry or very vulnerable also creates more clicks, more likes, more attention, so they can monetize on that. So probably they will incentivize better on, well, monetizing vulnerabilities than on the safety of people.
Mm-hmm. And I mean the spreading of, there's nothing in the business model that is contrary to the private social media business model that's contrary to deepening polarization or spreading propaganda or disincentivizing sort of toxic discourse. So those are all compatible actually with like the attention business model.
Yeah, it sounds actually also sad, and I think a lot of people can relate to these kind of things that they're seeing and happening. But I think there's also some parts of social media that actually bring a lot of joy and also spreads maybe news still to people as well. We became in many ways kind of dependent on these infrastructures laid out by big tech corporations. Do you think we can still counter that?
I hope so. That's, I feel like, a big thesis of our work, that critiques only go so far, and the fact that this is such a ubiquitous kind of media, and we all have experienced finding joy there and connection there, that I think we could recognize as not being of the toxic variety. I think the promise is real. For me, and I think for this project, it's sort of it's all about how it's designed and what it solves for, what it designs for, and I think how it's activated, like who is this a wide open space where there is no where there's no stewardship, where there's no figure who's trying to program. Like if you think of libraries or you think of parks, you do think of a librarian, you think of activities that are like organized and put together that draw people to a park.
People who actually care about the people there, about the space, how it's maintained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think those roles are more and more important. And on big platforms, on many platforms, you know, you think of moderation or moderators or folks who are charged in some way with removing dangerous content. That's maybe on one side to then something where there are more involved moderators or community managers. You think about like a platform like Reddit where there's a little bit more of an active presence. You think about something like Wikipedia where there's an even bigger role to sort of think about the veracity of stuff that folks are posting. Mm-hmm. So I think that those examples also bring me a lot of hope and like the, and as a facilitator, as like a professional facilitator, I feel like that is also my work that I see in the power in person, like what effect someone has who's thinking about the dynamics in the room and trying to foster the sort of environment.
Yeah, amazing. I think maybe this initiative or this incubator also originated from that hope that actually it can be a more beautiful and better place for people. So how does exactly the company or the organization work?
PSI, the project that I run, I feel like each of these programs kind of have a thesis about where in the sort of landscape of digital public spaces there is an opportunity that can meet the moment of need that we're in. And the Public Spaces Incubator was formed around this thesis that public service media, public broadcasters, have a really critical role. Actually, it's an intuitive part of their mandate to support an environment, a public space where where people can come, share accurate information, but then kind of hear from one another about how the public is experiencing that information or experiencing these world events. So a place where people can see and understand each other. That is a bit more of a public forum.
I'm curious, like how does this, let's talk a bit more about the public space incubator part, because then you need to collaborate with many different parties. How does that work? Mm-hmm. How is it governed?
Yeah, so there's sort of the the broader governance, and then there's kind of the day-to-day governance, and both of them are super interesting to me. And so the public spaces incubator is kind of the first of its kind. It's this multi-year partnership with New Public and six international public media service organizations across language, across culture, across continents. So the ABC in Australia, ARD in Germany, CBC Radio Canada, RTBF in Belgium, SRG in Switzerland, and ZDF in Germany. So all six of these, it spans Australian, North American, European time zones, three different languages. On the one level, which I think is important, there's a steering committee that is chaired by the and led by the broadcasters that's sort of sharing out the these fast moving updates in the landscape of social media across these organizations with each other, and then making decisions about the sort of strategic direction of the work in that space. And so it's really run in a very collective fashion at that level. And then in the work of the incubator itself, actually we're in this really interesting moment of transition where the first 3 years of, we've just been together for 3 years. And when the project was originally conceived, it was conceived as a 3-year project that would be producing very experimental concepts for the purposes of demonstrating that alternatives are possible. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like this is sort of a big bet. There's no guarantee after 3 years of work that we would have the inkling of things that could replace big platforms in this way. Mm-hmm. But I would say sort of halfway through that project, it became clear we created over 100 prototypes in a very collective way where we're working with audience members and staff members across all of these broadcasters in the kind of co-creation of these concepts.
And what kind of prototypes are you working on?
Small and large interventions. There's one right now that is, it's just, there's these small interventions that think about how to take essentially a poll, but how to create a dynamic and a conversation that is less polarized. And so rather than having something that is a yes, no question, have more spread and kind of emphasize in the visual design an invitation to respond to a question from a perspective that is not hard on either side, and just create a way for people who have that point of view. It's not trying to change people's points of view necessarily, but it's trying to create the digital hooks to allow for that perspective to be findable by people who are coming to a conversation in the space.
And how does that exactly originate? Like, for example, there are, I can imagine, some topics like polarization, maybe social connection that you want to tackle, and then from there you start experimenting, like how to maybe put it in a different perspective. What are the topics that you try to address?
So we had a year. The first year was this sort of year of discovery, year of research. We're trying to find what are these topics that are shared across all broadcasters. And there were three kind of big umbrella topics that we ended up designing around. One was this idea that we found, interestingly, so hard to translate, but everybody could kind of put their finger on what it was this idea of civic dialogue. What are tools that support that kind of conversation, and how is that conversation different than, say, one-to-one conversation with a friend, or a group conversation with friends and family? The idea of civic conversation is this sense that you're speaking to strangers who share a kind of public identity with you. And there will be difference. The point of a space like this, I think, we came to discuss, is more about being able to see and understand the range of opinions and experiences about an issue, more than it is to encourage every single person to participate or to support people who are already comfortable commenting, do it better. That this is more about representativeness.
Is it the same for all parties involved, or is that also cultural based?
The idea of civic conversation, civic dialogue.
Like, for example, the public values, or the values that are incorporated in these systems, are these similar throughout all the parties involved? I can imagine that there might be emphasized differently in different languages or different cultures.
I think there's a little bit of a different emphasis. And if you were to give every partner the 100 different concepts and say pick your best set, whatever, I think there would be some variety in there. But to go to your earlier question about how we got to what we've made, there was a really powerful moment in the project where we had to go from 100 prototypes, over 100 prototypes, to 8, the ones that we were going to build. And we had to make that decision as this very diverse consortium. And we did it. And we did it by consensus. The 8 concepts that we took from prototype form and actually built out within the product, those were collectively prioritized as the sets of tools that felt relevant to everyone.
Very democratic system. Okay, and the other topics, so there's civic dialogue. What were the other two?
And then there was another that was thinking about this idea of moderation as something that is, it is a difficult thing for any institution to do. But the emphasis has mostly been on how do you deal with toxic content once it's there, rather than how do you tone set? How do you set expectations? What's the sort of preemptive sort of conversation setup you can do to make the moderation downstream less of an issue?
Yeah.
So it was this sort of idea of proactive tone setting and proactive moderation.
Mm-hmm. And do you there feel like if you set, for example, a more positive tone, then people will follow that as well, instead of the negativity and the darkness?
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting research that is looking at the effect of the top level post in public digital spaces and what impact that has on, I mean, it is where people spend the most of their time and are making this sort of split second judgment about what is this space and what is its value to me. And so I think a lot has to do with what are the types of comments that are here and like valued here. But I don't think it's all that either. Like there's another body of research that I think is fascinating. That is just looking at the difference between how people comment in a space that's led with a question, even if it's this really open question, like, you know, how do you feel about the, or like, how are you affected by U.S. tariffs or something like that? Like this is a pretty open question, but rather than a kind of space where like anything goes and it's kind of up to the loudest or like most provocative, you know, person to sort of set like where everyone's attention is, you kind of share as you come into the space an implicit purpose. There's this question, we have perspectives about it. And that has a huge impact on then the type of dynamic that's in the space. And that is, you know, just by starting whatever intervention, whatever like fancy design with a question.
That's so interesting. And it also shows how powerful moderation is and also how bad it can be, especially when driven by commercial stakeholder interests, just only there to, you know, drag you down a rabbit hole. And I think, well, most of the big tech platforms, they don't really care if you fall down a rabbit hole of a conspiracy as long as they will earn money by it. And that's, I think, often to do with the moderation part. Yeah, it's actually quite strange, right, if you think about it, that we let a couple of tech billionaires decide who gets to say what in our society and which voices will be amplified and which will be lowered.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel like not a new dynamic or concept that, like, I mean, maybe new in like our kind of acquiescence, maybe, but the fact that like powerful people can amplify or diminish voices, I feel like is a problem.
It's an ancient problem, true. Yeah, and that's also got re-empowered by these technologies. So how to democratize that is, of course, quite a challenge. What's the final one? The third one
I feel like is maybe the least like theoretical and I won't undersell it. I think this is it's actually like such a fascinating problem, which is sort of two parts. So if we think about the current commenting paradigm, like in our heads, where as it relates to news, it's sort of like, okay, here's a piece of content and here's a like comment section about it. And so this third one was really trying to like hard get away from that in a couple ways. One is how do you create conversations that last beyond a single piece of content, so that news and content producers have kind of feet, like they do this with their content. They're not writing one story about a thing and then letting it go. These are important issues that that last for a while. And so how do you break the model so that like a conversation about an issue persists as long as that issue is relevant. So that was one element of it, but I think the other part that I find so fascinating.
Isn't it also part of moderation?
Like proactive moderation, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think calling people back into issues of relevance, but I think the fact that this is a space that is led by broadcast organizations, public media organizations that are also have this mandate around content creation.
Right.
The relationship between content and conversation is a really critical one. And so a model that is sort of like one-to-one conversation with piece of content is just not, it's not tenable, and it's sort of it's setting aside this kind of role of curator and activator, like you're kind of pointing to.
And so I'm wondering, like, for example, if you realize these prototypes or some of these prototypes are already existing, what's the vision for it? Do you want to incorporate them within other existing tools, or do you want to provide them to, for example, TikTok or Instagram, or do you want to build like a complete separate platform for these tools?
So we've kind of maintained from the beginning of this project that this isn't, we're not creating a whole new platform. And so what are we doing with them? I feel like that is really important. So a big part of this is bringing audiences for some conversations back to broadcasters' own platforms. So rather than sending conversation out to these private spaces, mm-hmm. how can conversation happen on platform? And so that is a big part of it. There's another really important part of this collaboration has been the commitment to open source the outputs. And for me, I think that is a really important moment if TikTok saw one of these interventions and like wanted to implement it, I feel like we have the confidence that these interventions are creating the types of healthier exchange that the internet needs. And so
that's also encouraged of course.
But I think another thing that it makes possible, this open sourcing, is the ability for these public broadcasters have been essentially investing in a public infrastructure that because of their mandates, because of their size, they've been able to sort of take a little bit of that risk. Where a small, like a local news organization or a small paper or a library, other spaces that don't have that kind of resource to invest and sort of spearhead an R&D project like this, will have access to an open source set of tools that have been refined over over testing with audiences across the world, so that they'll be able to have some confidence in being able to use them. So I think that's also a really powerful output, where the community of the consortium grows exponentially at that moment, and institutions that don't have the same resources can benefit mm-hmm. from them.
Yeah, and of course you're also processing data from people. How is that handled?
The current kind of arrangement, I feel like, makes sense with this consortium, where we have an agreement across us. But this includes anonymizing and aggregating logs from folks who have been using these tools. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to note, like, another thing that comes from this consortium is, in order for us to work together, we sort of defer to the most, the sort of strictest set of rules around issues like these. And so the tools are constructed to be GDPR compliant and are really thinking about anonymity. And they're like sort of at a stage where the volume of usage is very low. And the tools are changing kind of rapidly. So,
Right. Yeah, it's also kind of important to show also the world and also the industry that actually you can build very good systems, prototypes and platforms without harvesting and monetizing on people's data. And I think that's something that is very much needed, because everything and everybody is believing in this mystical idea that you need a ton of data to build something.
A really interesting part of that puzzle for me is also... and we do need data at a sort of aggregate level to be able to reinforce this thesis that there is better civic exchange happening here, or people who aren't commenting are finding value in this kind of conversation. And these are things that you do need thoughtful you need smart attention in what are the sorts of behaviors that you're trying to aggregate to make that case through data of how folks are actually using the platform. Mm-hmm. But I think it is important, I think, that in a big difference that it is not individualized in that way, that it's not trying to capitalize on a user's full profile and how they're using the space. It's way more indexed on what is this conversation like, and what in aggregate is are people's sort of relationship to conversations that have these kinds of comments versus those, or conversations that use this prototype versus others, or ones that are led by journalist and ones that aren't. So I think the data is really essential to making the case, and there's a lot in the sort of how do you do this in a moral way that is about much more sort of the specifics of what you log and what you store.
And surfing the needs of people instead of using it.
Serving the needs of advertisers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a completely different model. So to maybe end this conversation, what do you think the future of social media beholds, and does it even have a future?
It's a really good question. I think it is easy to feel overwhelmed, but also exciting. I think the fact that this is a really exciting time, I think, to reimagine social media. You see Twitter crumbling, you see Meta having lost so much trust, and you just have this sense that there is both the need and the dissatisfaction with the platforms that exist. And I think Blue Sky is a really interesting example. Blue Sky's rapid growth, in some ways it may feel like kind of a clone of Twitter, but the fact that it's a public benefit company, the fact that it's so small, and that there are 35 million users on this platform, I think just sort of speaks to this sort of dynamic of need and mistrust, distrust with current options. The other thing that I think is just, it's changing news, it's changing social media, is the rise of AI and how much content is generated by AI. And I think that it's also easy, in the same way that it's easy to hate on social media, that can feel overwhelming, but I think there also is good and bad to that. And so if I'm dreaming and thinking about the future of social media, the future of a positive social media, I think it does have to do with some of these. It's figured out how AI can be both a part of it, not just sort of separate from a space like that. It's also...
But also, that almost sounds like reimagining the creativity also that is allowed on the platform.
I think so. Well, I'm not an expert in AI, but I feel like from where I sit, I feel like there's so many places where we could think about it as a functional part of a platform. So there's the content that's generated by folks who are using a platform, and whether that is AI or not, or created by an AI agent or not, you know, there's sort of the user-generated side of things. But then there's also, I think, there's such a powerful way. AI is a powerful tool also for synthesis and being able to quickly kind of sense make from like what is happening in a space. It's also a really powerful tool for translation. So taking different kinds of information and processing it or presenting it in different ways. So I think that there are, and it's so responsive to and can be individualized in that way. And so I think there is, when you drill down a few levels and think about like how to thoughtfully and responsibly integrate it into what makes a platform special or what makes a tool feel relevant to somebody, there are a lot of applications there. And I think that it's helpful for me just to separate that from the kind of challenge of verification or how do you manage like the volume of user-generated content that's coming into a space.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That was so interesting. And I hope it gives, well, a little bit of hope, but also maybe some sadness mm-hmm. to people on the current state, but also maybe the future to be reimagined. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Thanks for chatting.